The bunker is one of the major costs for a ship. Every day that the vessel loses is money that the owner is losing or the charterer is losing. So you have 20 minutes to take a decision because the price fluctuates. And then you might end up paying more in 20 minutes or even less, but that one, it's your gamble. You need memory because you need to remember everyone. You need to remember every port and what is available there, who's available there. Then I realized how much is the impact of something like that, which is the hidden part of the business, on a lot of our things around us.
Welcome everyone, welcome back to a new podcast episode. So today we are joined by Davide Anginoni. I don't know if I pronounce it.
That's a difficult one. It's Anginoni, G-H.
So you are a bunker trader with with more than 15 years of experience in the bunkering industry. So today in this episode, we are going to explore the world of bunkering and the role of a bunker trader. So maybe can you introduce yourself, Davide?
Thank you for having me here today. It's a pleasure to share my experience with your subscribers and the people listening to your channels. Then me briefly, I'm an Italian man from Genova, which is a city in Italy that is very much exposed to shipping and the brokering and this kind of type of business. So my education comes from this as well. I studied in Genova business maritime, which is a particular segment of the general business in Italy, but I chose it a bit because of the environment I was already living into and because it was a very, very specific as a type of job for the future, all right? So I started there and then thanks to my connection, I entered this magic world of the bunkers, which is a bit behind the scene compared to other commodities, or at least in the oil commodity. But it's quite important part of the business. As you surely know, the bunker is one of the major costs for a ship. So obviously that has a huge impact on the cost of it and eventually on the final cost of the product as an end user ourselves. So I started in Monte Carlo in Monaco in 2008. So we're going back in time. And it was I spent 3 years there with an Italian company. And 3 years later, they relocated me to Genova, my hometown, where the headquarters was, to replace a friend who had an amazing experience in Haiti to help little kids. So I kind of took over his place. And after 3 years, I moved to London because I felt that was a good occasion to go into the center, the hub center of at least in Europe for commodities at that time. And after a bit, even London probably was a bit too complicated, and we moved to Geneva with my family 5 years and a bit ago, and happily here.
Great. So Geneva, which is the place, for trading, it's a good place.
Indeed, I fully agree with you. It became quite hot in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, a lot of, not only on the oil, you have agriculture, you have other commodities, which metals, which actually became quite of a spot in Europe. And then, yes, I agree with you for that.
Okay. Now I want to ask you this question. What is a bunker trader? What is your role, your mission on a day in your life?
Yes. So the job is I would describe it as a simple job itself, all right? It's not that complicated, but it requires a lot of patience, a lot of soft skills, if they call it like this in English, I think. So you need to have a good relationship with people. You need to be able to read them if you can, and support. The job itself, it's simply to put in contact an owner or a charterer who requires petrol and fuel for their ships to reach point A to point B and find them what they need and guide them perhaps through this process. So the day is very simple. You wake up, you get someone asking, giving you name of the ship, port of call, type of product that they need for their own ship and the quantity they need and the date of the arrival of the ship in that port. Your job is to provide them a price of what they have asked, or at least what you could find in that port, to satisfy their needs. There will be a negotiation afterwards where eventually you end up signing up a contract or whatever, exchanging a contract email. Then the good part of the bunkering trader is that it's diversified throughout the day because you have different markets. Yeah. So you have Asia market in the morning, which trades in some particular hours, which is normally the closure of Platts in Singapore, which is 4:30 Singapore time, which is depends on the legal time or daytime, whatever they're called. It's around 8 to 10 in the morning. And it's very active, but it's a very short window.
Okay.
Then you move into the Mediterranean European time zone, which goes from 10:30 in the morning, Europe time, until 6.
Mm-hmm.
5:30 is the Platts closure, 4:30 UK, 5:30 Swiss time, as well for the ships to be fixed, which then eventually leads you to be able to close the deal for the owner. So they know where the ship is going, they fix the cargo, then they fix the bunker.
That's okay, very right. Okay.
So then you have America, which is normally from 4 p.m. Europe time until 8, 9, depends on which coast of America. So it's kind of a full day, I would say. Then not every day you see the full spectrum, but generally that's the way it is. So it's pretty busy. And of course, depends on the client. You have to approach them in a different way. Some clients are probably a bit more direct as well. Depends on the culture.
Yeah.
So some of the clients tend to be very sharp, quick. Some others tend to be a bit more laid back, take their time to make a decision, they have to evaluate properly. So you kind of adapt. I think that's the beauty of it. You see the full type of personality, the full spectrum of type of personalities from buyer to buyer, culture from buyer to buyer. So it's very interesting. And something that I think it's particularly unique is the fact that you serve charter and ship owners the same way, all right, but they have a completely different view of what you're offering to them, because the owner of course is the owner of the ship itself, therefore he has a certain type of care, while the charter is someone that's just renting the ship, so his attention is not to the bunker but is to the cargo that is actually he needs to ship it somewhere. So it's quite a unique role, I would say, in that respect.
It's funny what you say, because it looks a little bit like the role of a ship broker in a way that you're specialized on fuel, but the clients are quite the same. You still have this market in the morning, in the evening, depending the part of the world. So it's quite interesting. What is your added value, I would say, as a bunker trader?
I think, in my opinion, and this has been my way of working ever since I started, is trying to not only to give them to the client, to give them a price according to their needs, but it is to guide them towards a possible alternative option that he hasn't been able to evaluate for that particular needs of that ship. So to give you an example, you can have a vessel that is calling a port A to port B. And you could be probably able to lift bunker in the port A concurrently with the cargo operation. If it's a tanker, most likely not, but if it's a bulker, yes. And then you're going to ship your goods to the point B. Now, the cost of the bunker in the point A might be sensibly higher than stopping somewhere on the way to refill your ships. So what you could try to guide the client through is the way he would look at this. If he looks purely saving time, not money, perhaps purchasing the product at the point A is the best option. But what if he has a certain type of latent flexibility to the arrival port and he could save $100,000 by purchasing the product elsewhere on the route? So you could give him several options and then he would be able to make his own decision with a better knowledge of what he's actually deciding. I think the role of the bunker trader in part is this. Then the added value that commonly a bunker trader does is to cover up the mismatch, the financial mismatch between the moment the money is received by a ship owner or a charter for their freight, which tends to be, I think, 90 days, 60 days, depends on the deals, but it doesn't normally happen right after the ship is chartered. You tend to get the money at the end or after. So the bunkering payment terms tend to be shorter than this. Therefore, your cash flow as a charterer or an owner could be quite heavily impacted by the fact that the bunker you pay up front, your freight you receive later. So sometimes the role of the bunker trader is to cover this financial mismatch. Therefore, as a bunker trader, I could sell the product to you as an owner, and you pay to me after 60 days perhaps, instead of after 15 days, allows you to keep your cash in your pocket for 45 days more. Okay. And in the meanwhile, perhaps you have received the funds from the freight partners of yours. So this is as well quite of a role for the bunker trader. It's a kind of a little financial institution, but with a bit more like bunkering approach, because they know what they are doing in that respect. So it does play this kind of role as a cash flow or ATM machine for some owners and charter. Of course, they pay a premium, but that premium perhaps could be less than what an interest rate from a bank would be to have this exposure on the cash flow. So it depends on how you look at that. But it is kind of that the added value that you could bring. I still believe that the first example I give you is the real added value that would make the difference between a bunker trader and a bunker trader. The second is most commonly known as an added value to the owners and the charterer. Eventually, you could have a third point, which is the fact that, let's say, if you are a young company and you have chartered in 3-4 ships, all right, you don't have the name and you don't have the appeal in the market to be able to purchase a good such as bunker without paying in advance for that.
Okay.
And the trader would be able to take the economic risk or the credit risk of serving you while a bank would not.
Okay.
So you kind of have this role as a bunker trader.
But if you advance the fund, I mean, you pay in advance for the fuel, do you like trade the future of this?
You could. Some charterers tend to do that in order to lock their bunkering price and their freight fluctuation, and so that they know exactly what their voyage would produce in terms of profit. Okay. If you don't do that, you're of course exposed to this fluctuation. So actually, a lot of charterer, mostly I would say, they do this in order for them to make sure that they have already a P&L even before the voyage starts. So they lock it in and they are happy with that. And it's quite common, yes.
Okay, it's interesting. For example, sometimes that when you do some fresh calculation, for example, as a broker, you take into consideration the bunkering price at Rotterdam, at Singapore. It's a fixed price, it changes every day. For you, what is the impact of it? What is your role with it?
Yeah, so the role that we had few clients, or I had few clients personally, that I was helping them taking a decision on when it would be a better day to purchase. There are several factors in affecting the value, or the flat price, whatever we call it. And these are obviously economical, it could be political, so there are many, many factors, as we know, same for the shipping and for the freight market, all right? So the best way is to know which index are going to be published in which day, which type of performances from some American index in particular will be released. Therefore, you know that day there will be an impact.
Okay.
If you have a forecast on that, if you have your, let's say, feeling about what the market is doing, you could probably tell the client, listen, don't buy this week, buy next week.
Okay.
Or the way around, you could say, I know that you are going to perform this voyage, as you told me, be aware that your timing for buying the bunker is better be earlier than later, because there, we expect congestion in that area. So if you come too late, you might not be able to receive what you have been asking for. So try to do it a week early if you can. Despite of the price, it helps your logistics. So there are several ways to approach this. And then I think that's something that it should be always kept in mind as a bunker trader.
Interesting. I can see the knowledge you need to have is quite shipping, actually. Because usually commodities trader, it's commodities jobs oriented more about commodities than shipping. But in your case, do you need to have more like this shipping profile, maritime profile, trading profile, or mix of everything?
I think it's you actually touched quite a good point. I think that the more of a shipping profile, I think it's quite adapted to the bunkering, because it's a side effect of the shipping, while the commodity or the oil cargo trading, it's the reason why there is a shipping.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah. So the shipping is the reason why, you know, is the consequence of the oil trading, while the bunker is the consequence of the shipping moving. Okay. So I think shipping is in between the two.
Okay. We consider a commodities trader the charterer, and you have a ship owner. You are completely intermediate. I mean,
yes.
You are like a ship broker, you are in the middle, the middleman. Okay. You know, I didn't know about it. For me, it's quite new. So it's great. Okay, let's talk a little bit about maybe how you negotiate sourcing process bunker fuel.
Yeah, so as we said before, once you receive an inquiry from your clients, you have an idea of what he needs and where he needs it, all right? Since there are a lot of tools nowadays which help you tracking the shipping movements, and then in particular of that ship, so you could go and see where the shipping is departing from, where the shipping is going to go. And you can start, first of all, analyzing whether you are compliant with that ship. Nowadays, a lot of things have changed. As I was saying before, even political decisions have an impact. And lately, this is one of the impact. If it's not sanctioned, you'd have to go through your internal compliance. After that, what you would do, you try to collect the prices from the suppliers which are physically available in that port for that specific product that your client needs. Therefore, your job is to offer him what is the best option suitable for his needs. So you as a trader, you choose among the list of offers that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Price oriented, of course, number one. But secondly, could be as well, you know, this supplier, I know it's more reliable than the other one that is cheaper. So I would offer you the one that is slightly more expensive, and I tell you, but you probably have a better service. Then it's still your decision, because it's your bunker deciding which one is the best for you. But my job is to give you the options. And something else that it should be done, as I was mentioning before, give you the options alternative to what to the ones that you have requested. So there is another port that you're going passing by after. What if you look at that option, which is cheaper than this and it's safer? And then you can say, listen, here it costs like this, but if you buy in this other port, which anyway you're passing by, or sort of passing by, you could get this price. Then it's his call. You give him a time, you have a deadline. You cannot.
Yeah.
It's like in the shipping.
Yeah, exactly.
Normally it's not 6 p.m. or the day after. Yeah. It's 20 minutes.
Okay. Right?
So you have 20 minutes to take a decision because the price fluctuates.
Yeah.
And then you might end up paying more in 20 minutes or even less, but that one, it's your gamble.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait and see, right? And then the owner would come back, or your client would come back and say, listen, I need this, or please, can you do better? And then you finalize the negotiation when you find a number that makes you happy as a client and as a trader, makes you profitable with the supplier on the other side. So what is very important, which is something that it might be not appearing at the first look as a bunker trader, is the fact that, yes, you need to have a client that supports you and gives you business, but you need to have suppliers that support you. If you do not have suppliers, your connection with the clients might be worthless.
I understand.
Because you won't be able to get any price for him.
Okay.
So you are in between.
Okay, it's like broker.
So you need. Information
is our add value. You as well. It's your connection with the supplier of fuel.
Exactly, and that's the reason why an owner or a charterer would need sometimes a trader, because especially in a market, in a Trump type of business, where the vessels are traditionally changing their routes, mm-hmm. not always exactly going from point A to point B for a year, what instead a container liner does or a cruise liner does, you might not have the knowledge as an owner or a charterer who's available in that port, because you don't go there often. Okay. While the trader who has multiple clients, he would in somehow channel these inquiries to this dedicated port. So his connection with the supply, it would be certainly better than what you could have if you speak directly to the supply, because you go there once a year. Me as a trader, I go there 20 times a month. So I could help you with my relationship and passing on to you.
Okay.
So in this particular way, you need to have the suppliers on your side too that would support you to make your clients happy.
Understanding. Okay, very interesting. And I wanted to ask you as well about transportation, the voyage itself. Sometimes vessel have for example, Rotterdam to Singapore. You need to bunker in maybe around like South Africa. How are you managing when you have few ports of destination and port calls, I would say?
Yes. So generally for every client or for most of the client, the driver is always the price. I think the equation is price versus time. Every day that the vessel loses is money that the owner is losing or the charterer is losing, okay? Then the benchmark is how much time can I lose compared to how much money can I save? So if you said Rotterdam to Singapore, we forget Suez for now, because it doesn't exist anymore, or at least it's there physically, but not in our daily life. Then you have West Africa along the coast, or South Africa. Traditionally, we know that these are not the best ports to do bunker, because they're very expensive, the logistic is complicated.
FPSO, it's usually
it's a bit a no-go unless it's needed. Then you have probably something in between. You have a couple of other options. You have Gibraltar area, or Algeciras. You have Las Palmas. So you kind of help the owner and say, listen, if you need to go from A to B, I think here is probably your best shot. Okay. But several factors play into the game, which are not related to the bunkers, but related to other services of the ships. You have crew changes sometimes. Yeah. You have spare parts, you have lubricants, and perhaps maybe in the specific port where you're suggesting to do bunker, they don't do lubricants.
Okay.
Therefore, the owners would need an extra stop somewhere else. And then it's a double stop. Then your suggestion doesn't work. Of course, you don't know that as a trader, because that stands on the shipping side. But once you are aware of that, if your client would share that information with you, you will be able to assess that and factor that into in the offer, all right? So, but that one is an example, or you need hull cleaning, you know, all this.
Yeah, you have so many.
So many other things related to the shipping, which are not visible on the bunkering, but they would affect the decision. They would drive the decision of the owner. So your best shot is always to be transparent and clear and say, these are your options. Choose and pick. I could try to support you wherever you want. Maybe here is better, but still, I think that's what you do on a daily basis for you guys. So
very
this kind of specific question.
Okay. On the in terms of transportation of fuel, are you doing like the, for example, if you need to buy some fuel in Singapore and send it to another port?
You cannot do that. Generally, you need to have a bunkering license in each port according to the barge. So the bunkering industry is structured in a way that if you are a physical supplier of bunker, you are a physical supplier in that specific location within the normally is the port limit of the area. So you have some occasion where the barge could move from one port to the nearest port, but it's unlikely that a barge would be able to supply here and then 10 days sailing elsewhere,
okay, but right?
Unless it's offshore.
Okay, but the fuel needs to be from somewhere, for example, in Rotterdam.
Yes.
In the Netherlands, we don't produce so many oils. So.
That one comes from commodity traders. So that's the
okay.
Yes.
Yeah, now understanding the picture of it. Okay.
That comes from the commodity traders, okay, which resell to the physical suppliers. Some of them are as well producer. Happens to the majors, of course, but majority of the physical suppliers in the bunkering industry, they are not producer. They are importers of finished product or of product which will be blended eventually by them and resell as a finished product.
Yeah, okay, so it's good if I wanted to ask you the question, what is the difference between a commodity trader and a bunker trader?
That's the difference. That's the difference.
I think as a bunker trader, you know a lot about fuels.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit technical now, because I think it's quite interesting. Could you walk us through the different types of fuels? Because in the maritime industry, we have HFO, VLSFO, we have MGO. Can you explain everything about it?
You have definitely different products. Yeah. This, when I started, didn't exist, all right? There were only two fuels. The things have changed, regulation have changed. Normally, the reason why it changes is because of a government regulation. Is never because the ship needs a different fuel, which is something quite interesting, but it's always a political decision that drives eventually then the type of product which will be available. Commonly, you have two main products, the fuels which are used for the engine propulsion, and then you have distillates, such as gas oil, which are used for generator of the ship. So these are the two main lines, streams of product that you could put on a vessel. On the engine, you have several type of fuels. You have HSFO, which means high sulfur fuel oil. So VLSFO, very low sulfur fuel oil. And then you have ultra-low sulfur fuel oil, which is, let's say, the latest product available in terms of existence. And they are all driven by the content of the sulfur in it. So everything is related to pollution and regulation about pollution. All right. So that's the sustainability of the industry. The HSFO, which is the product that was available only and exclusively for the ship's engine, now has a content of sulfur which is 3.5, or commonly say 3.5. The 0.5 is the VLSFO, and 0.1 is the ultra-low sulfur fuel oil.
The sulfur amount.
Correct. The particle of sulfur into the product. Now, the cheapest is the heavy fuel. All right, the heaviest, the cheapest.
Okay,
but of course it's the one that released the biggest amount of pollution in the air. In order to change this regulation in 2020, the IMO decided to lower down, to cap this sulfur content to 0.5 worldwide basis. It was the first time in the history that on a worldwide basis is the sulfur content was cut so heavily. Then, in order for the ships to be able to burn HSFO, which they still do, you have to install a scrubber, which is a desulfurization.
Not all ships have them, but many of them we can.
But many of them, in order to lower down the sulfur content. This would bring you a cost as an owner, of course, but we will bring you the benefit of being able to burn a product that is cheaper. So in the long run, you will save money. So these three products are HSFO, as we said, which you can burn wherever you want in the world, as long as you have scrubbers on board. 0.5, very low sulfur, which is you can burn it wherever you want in the world, excluded three areas, which is USA, is not allowed. North of Europe is not allowed. And from 2025 May in the Mediterranean.
Oh, okay.
In those three areas, you can burn maximum 0.1
in the Mediterranean, it will come.
It will come as a regulation in place from next year.
I didn't see that we have this regulation.
So the ultra-low sulfur fuel oil is actually commonly used only within these areas. But the content of sulfur in the ultra-low sulfur fuel is the same that is in the gas oil, the marine gas oil, which you use, as we said, for the generator of the ship, for the electricity, for the heating, for all this rest. So the debate has always been traditionally whether it's convenient to purchase a fuel with a 0.1 sulfur content or it's better to buy directly gas oil.
Okay.
Ship can run on gas oil.
They can, but
because it's the most expensive among the four, and there are all the technical consideration afterwards on the engine, whether it's better to ride the engine with gas oil or not, which is, the answer is not. It's better to run it on the fuel, heavy fuel, right? Sure. But the debate is it convenient really to use, burn 0.1 fuel in this limited area when the ship tends to travel anyway outside of this area most of the time? It's just passing by or stopping by.
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of a complicated decision by the owners to decide which type of fuel going to purchase for their own ships. Of course, then your role comes in on a charter party. What is the rule of the charter party? Which product should I use? Should I use gas oil or fuel? You know, there's a lot of legal boundaries there which needs to be considered, not only the ship itself and the best option for the ship, but everything else that is related to it. So these are the commonly products found in the industry. Of course, we are going towards a transition, as we said. We're trying to get greener. We're trying to diversify this type of product into product which would have a less impact with our earth. Now, the most common product alternative fuel used is the LNG.
Yeah, but
which has been there forever for many other reasons, but never used on the engine of a ship, which is becoming more and more popular. We see on the order books, you guys as well, do this. You see that there is a tendency to have a bit more...
we have the demand for it on...
vessel dual fuels.
Methanol, we have...
So you have a lot of lot of things. So it's a very particular timing for shipping and for commodities as well, or oil-driven commodities. Now, what I see and what is known is that obviously the LNG has a quite of an expensive cost.
Yeah.
So it's not as cheap as any of the others, and is not as available as the others. So It's a niche type of product yet. The other fuels, they do have as well a particular relation between the type of the vessel and the type of fuel. So to give you an example, a vessel that is consuming a lot of tons of fuel per day and tends to be quite big and tends to have quite a long voyage, which is natural when you have a big ship, you tend to do longer voyages. You tend to have scrubbers on board.
Yeah.
Okay. Simply because every tons that you consume, you would pay more if you put 0.5 instead of HSFO. So you have $100 difference, more or less, between the two products. So if you consume 30-50 tons a day of that specific product, the difference between these two products every day, it's a lot of money, right? So, but the big ships that tend to have a longer voyage, they tend to be liners, containers mostly, which are the biggest consumers of HSFO. Cruises, ferries, you do have as well tankers and bulkers, but mostly for Cape on the bulkers, and, you know, Afra, Supra, VLCC, you know, the big guys.
Very long.
Very long, yeah. They save a lot of money. Exactly. Okay, while VLSFO, the 0.5, is more adaptable, if we could call it this way, to shorter voyages, smaller ships, handy, you know, that kind of. So they have low consume per day compared to bigger ships, shorter voyages, so more time in the port, less time navigating. So all in all, it's okay to pay a bit more.
Okay.
The consequence of it is that you do not find HSFO wherever you want, but you tend to find in the major port where liners are calling. Okay. While VLSFO, you find it pretty much everywhere.
Okay.
Because the Trump business serves everywhere, while the liners, as we said, they are more specific in some areas. So Singapore, Rotterdam, you know, the main Fujairah, the main areas, right? While the 0.1 fuel is just only exclusively in the Seca and Ica area, which are driven by political decision, all right? So that's something as well to consider.
So you already touched to this, but the main advantages and disadvantages of each type of fuel. You mentioned the diesel, for example, is not the best one. Do you have explanation about it?
Oh, it's very technical. I'm not that technical. I tried to learn with it, but I think it's about the calorific power.
Okay.
So the quantity of product that you need to consume to achieve the same speed, it's higher in terms of gas. So you will have to, I'm not sure about that, but you need to consume more tons of that product to be able to run at the same speed of HSFO or VLSFO. So there is, the fuel works better. So the dirtiest the product you can burn, which is the one that costs the least, the better it is. So the engine is, technology has been going towards that. So now thinking to feed the engine with something on high value and high cost is just the opposite of what we have been looking at in the past 10, 15 years, all right? So generally the ships, especially the big ships, they are very good at running with very cheap fuel, all right? So that's the reason why as well they have scrubbers.
I have just one question, is to come back, it's like about, you know, you have sulfur, but you have EV on light fuels. What are the
Okay, so that one, it's the way you get to have finished product as a bunker from crude, of course, you go through a refining process, all right? So as you mentioned, you have generalizing two type of crude, light and heavy. Let's just remain to these two. There are several there's, but let's categorize in two. So obviously it is related to the sulfur content, natural sulfur content with and some other specific characteristic which I'm not very technical enough to be able to explain. But obviously, from processing a light crude, you tend to have a material which is lighter in terms of sulfur content. Therefore, it's easier then to be blended to obtain 0.5 fuel.
Okay.
The heavy crude would allow you to produce 3.5 fuel more easily. Now, what we need to consider in this particular case, this is not related to bunker, is relating to refining process. You convert a material in barrel into a material in tons, okay? And in order for you to understand the value that you could bring, or you could extract from a barrel of crude, you need to have the reflex on it, on the value on the product. So this is called crack.
Okay,
so the value per barrel of crude versus a value per barrel of a finished product, that would give you the crack, so the difference, all right? So simply saying, when you produce high sulfur fuel from any crude, your crack is negative. So whatever you produce value less than what you had paid originally. But because the refining process goes through
more
several phases on the on the first phase is you obtain high value products. So light distillate, middle distillate, only at the end with whatever is left of the chain of the production you have, you get to residual vacuum, which is then used to produce fuel. So you still have, as a consequence of your process, which makes money, you obtain a product that doesn't make money, which is the HSFO. Okay. So you still have it, but you tend to minimize that if possible. On the other end, you have cracks of VLSFO, which are positive. So whatever product comes out of the process as a light residual vacuum to produce 0.5 fuel still makes money for the refiner.
Okay.
So these are the main two differences between the two fuels. So one makes money even for the refinery, the other one doesn't. Okay. But it's a side effect. So both are side effects, but one is better than the other, economically speaking. So obviously depends on the complexity of the refinery to be able to process a certain type of crude, which goes way beyond the decision of a refinery to produce HSFO or VLSFO. All the decisions are driven by the other product.
It's interesting. Okay.
All right, so it's a bit more complicated, yeah. But when we get to the point, the reason why HSFO is cheaper than VLSFO is the crack.
Okay, very interesting question.
So, let's say today, VLSFO could cost $650, let's say like this, or $550, whatever number, and you take $100 less and you have the HSFO.
Okay.
All right, so for the refinery, these are $100 less on pretty much the same product or kind of residual vacuum that you anyway have from the production. So it's better to have 0.5 as a refinery. Okay. For the client, makes sense to burn the HSFO because they save money, but not only for them makes sense to buy it, all right? Okay. The bunker trader that is in between doesn't care, because your profit doesn't stand with the flat price, but it stands on the profit that you add on top of that 400 or 500 or 600. Yes. So it's a completely different way of looking at things. And therefore, the correlation between Brent movement and price of the finished product is not directly correlated.
Okay.
It is correlated. Obviously, yes, if the Brent skyrockets, of course, the price is going to go higher. But it's not going as high as the Brent. They don't do this movement.
Okay, I understand. It's not, there is no correlation.
Because the cracks drives the price.
Okay. Interesting what you say. You anticipate very nicely my questions. It's more, it's very technical. You know that depending the part of the world we take the crude oil, we have different level of sulfur. For example, North Sea and Texas, it's the most common one. It's very nice one because it's low sulfur. If you take in for example, around Dubai area, this is very, very high sulfur, EV sulfur. What can you say about the final price at the end? On, I mean, because it's an impact. If you produce a specific type of fuel in this part of the world, it will be, is it like, it's 100% sure that it will be each part of the world has its own characteristic, I would say.
But yes.
Can make the work.
Generally, you do have, let's say, different type of crudes, depends on the complexity of your refinery and the geographical position of your refinery compared to where you can source your crude.
Yeah.
Certainly that would have an impact, for the reason that you still need to ship the crude from a point to another point. That goes without saying that the freight impact on the crude has an impact on your choices of the crude itself. So let's say if you are in Asia and you tend to bring, let's bring the example of China, that is probably the biggest importer of crude by far, than any other place in the world, any other country in the world. They tend to purchase the African crude, heavy, some of them quite heavy, of course, Middle East products. It's possible, but it's rare that they would buy something from America. because the distance as well would impact the price. So still the geographical position plays a role in the decision making on the crude purchase too. Okay. It's similar to the bunker. Then you have the reflex on the bunker of it, because let's say if you have, let's speak about the Arabic Peninsula, you know, they have the access to have heavy crude oil underground, all right?
Yeah.
So for them, it's clearly cheaper to process that than bringing something else from somewhere else. Then, of course, the production that they will have in loco there, the price of the bunker will be probably cheaper than bunker that is produced there physically and then carried as a commodity to another point, because then you have to add the freight on top. So that price will be higher than this price. Then you create a situation where you have different pricing for the same product across the world. So you never have the same product. Okay. Sorry, you never have the same price for the same product in different parts of the world. You have a bracket within which...
So you have the flats and you have the...
And then you have a plus 30, minus 30, plus 15 on that index.
Okay.
But that's the reason why. Because some places they do have and produce and sell locally the product. And then someone else needs to import it. And you know, when you import, you certainly pay higher than someone that has it physically downstairs.
Okay,
right? So then you can kind of read through the difference of the prices. If you take any price indication on a daily basis of the same product across the world, you would spot these differences and you would understand why it's cheaper or it's more expensive because of the belongings. I think traditionally cheapest place to buy bunker has been Russia ever since, all right?
Oh, yeah.
Let's forget about the last years. These are unique years, all right?
Yeah,
but the bunker in Russia has been traditionally the cheapest bunker you could ever buy.
Okay.
They have crude, they process it, they sell it there. So it's interesting, but it would give you a bit of an idea of where the flow of the products, crude moves in, products move out.
Okay.
Once you have this, you kind of assess.
So what you say, this is not only about the product and the quality of the product, but you need to add on the final cost, like the transportation, I mean, the distance between each place. It's very interesting.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Let's talk more about your role as a bunker trader. Sometimes you need to advise your clients about the type of fuel. Maybe you should use this EV fuel on because you don't have a scrubber on board. Or...
So what is... what you could do for a client, and I think it's something that helps them in the decision, because which type of product they need, they would tell you. So this is something it's in their responsibility to decide. Your job could be the one of telling this particular port where you're looking for bunker. Let's say you look for HSFO. I know that there has been quite a lot of troubles with the quality, perhaps.
Yeah.
So as a trader, I would recommend you to avoid purchasing in this port your HSFO, because you might incur into a quality issue. If you do have a chance, you need to check your ROBs on board if you could reach another port after that without being in troubles in terms of safety for the ship. I would suggest you to look at option B first, because quality would give you a major downside.
Okay.
First of all, you are not using that product that you have on the ship. You need to discharge it, perhaps, which means you lose time because you will have to offload something that you already spent time to put it on. So, plus you will not be able to burn it. So you will still have to stop somewhere else to refill some new product that you need to burn.
Okay.
Because traditionally you have to imagine that if you buy bunker, you're not going to use, it's not like for your car.
No.
Let's say you have no petrol in your car, you go to the first petrol station, you put the petrol and you go. So the consumption of the product that you put in your car is immediate.
Yeah.
For the ship, it's not like this. for the ship, you put the product on board. That product tends to be used 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks after you put it on the ship. In the meanwhile, it's been tested to make sure that the product is safe for use.
Okay. Is it even the very famous part on Windows that
yes. Okay. You do that as a standard basic rules. So you have 2-3 weeks before you actually use that product. Okay. That means you need to have enough of the previous load. All right, so you have to think the segregation of the tanks on a ship. You have some product that you had already on board and is sitting in, let's say, tank one. Then I have another two tanks, all right? If I fill them both with the new product and is off spec, then maybe I'm in trouble, because then I cannot use tank two and tank three. I can only rely on tank one. So what I have to do, if I have off spec on the tank two and tank three, I need to find a way to stop before and fill on top the tank one, which is never recommended for compatibility between the products.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect.
For the HSFO, it's okay. If you put HSFO on top of another HSFO, you shouldn't have problem. If you do it for gasoil, you have no problem. If you do for VLSFO, you might have a huge problem. Okay. So you don't do it.
Because of the different.
Because it's not the same finished product, therefore there are asphalting, it's something technical, but you might have a problem by using that fuel. You might stuck your engines, so you don't do it. So what an owner would do most likely would be, okay, maybe keep a third tank still free for emergency. So you very rarely use tank two the day after. You use your tank one. Once you have a result of the test, you move to use the next tank.
Okay,
so that would give you time. But therefore, if you know that in that port, you'd have a tendency to have a bad fuel, which give troubles, you might guide your clients. Say, listen, I spoke to a friend yesterday that had issues in this port last week. I cannot guarantee 100% that you would get the same problem. But the ship is yours, the decision is yours, but perhaps choose another option if you could. That's something that I think it comes within the role, as we said even previously. So I think that's a common sense by a trader to advise, because you have access to information for a port which could be deeper than what an owner has, because you speak to suppliers on a regular basis, you know, for many other reasons. As I said before, you might not speak to anyone locally for 3 months because you don't call that port for 3 months. But I do speak to them because I have other owners that call that port when you were not calling that port. So I can update you with some information. It's the same as you guys.
Yes, that's right. No, so sharing on, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And that one, it's quite of an example of how you could drive a decision, or you could help a decision making. Because quality matters. Price, I told you before, price is always the reason number one when you take a decision. You want to go for the cheapest option for your ship because it's a cost. Or you reduce the cost, you maximize your profit. But on the other side, that decision should take into consideration the possible side effect of going for the cheapest option. It might not be the best option. It might look the cheapest, but if you have a quality claim, you might end up having
cost maintenance,
lubricant that you need, or, you know, so
it's a long term again.
It's a headache that you could avoid perhaps spending maybe $10 more per ton on the next port. Then again, we go back to the point that I give you the suggestion. If you prefer your $10 saving with the risk, no problem.
Okay.
But you need to be aware, in my opinion, as a trader, that you could have taken a different decision. If you don't, if I don't tell you, you don't know, you basically just go for it. But if you at least have the chance to make a decision with a proper information, then, you know, you certainly will do the best in your opinion, for your company and your own ships.
Okay. Interesting. I have two last questions to ask you.
Sure.
The first one, this is for someone who already work as a banker trader, what kind of, in terms of geography in the world, in 2024, we are in November, 1st of November, what are the cheapest fuels, the better quality? I mean, giving you like a geographic picture of it.
Okay, for cheapest nowadays is excluding Russian again, because you know not many ships call Russia anymore for various reasons. Is ARA, Rotterdam is the cheapest, but it's the one where you have the biggest issues in terms of quality and quantity. So the way the market industry has been regulated in the past years, I would say probably Singapore is the safest. You do still have hiccups there. But besides the fact that it's the biggest hub in the world for bunker by far, the reason why it works well is that there is one organization that is the MPA, which is the Port Authority of Singapore, that takes decision exclusively. ARA is Antwerp, Rotterdam, Amsterdam, so they're two different countries.
Okay.
So you can't make a decision with two different cultures, two different countries, politicians and everything. While there, it's basically a one-man show, all right? They decide, everyone says yes. No discussion, all right?
Okay.
So they manage to regulate the way bunkering is done in a way that you minimize your risks as an owner in terms of quality and quantity. Of course, you might have troubles, but proportionally is much less than in other areas.
Okay.
Of course, this, the more regulated the market is, the more expensive tends to become. So traditionally, since I started, Rotterdam and Singapore, they were pretty much in line. Singapore could have been sometimes cheaper. Now it's higher than Rotterdam. But still remains the biggest hub. Plus, we always have to consider that when you compare prices, you could compare the numbers, but the fact that Rotterdam is cheaper, it doesn't mean that you can go and buy in Rotterdam.
Okay.
Because let's say, you said before, a good example, you have Rotterdam to Singapore. Yeah, but if you don't have enough product to reach Singapore, you have to buy bunker before Singapore anyway. And if it's the way around and you are in Singapore, you say, okay, I will buy in Rotterdam. Yeah, but can you get to Rotterdam? So you can't just put the numbers. You just need to insert the number in the equation.
It's not about these economics rules, about bunkering. Singapore is the biggest port for bunkering, but it's not the cheapest. And it's not the highest. It could be the highest because everyone wants to bunker the ships.
Yes, I would say there's always a trade-off at some point where if you increase $100 per ton, the price in Singapore, some of the demand of Singapore would shift naturally to other ports. So you need a balance there. But, and I think that's been quite of a common example. I worked for a Japanese company for many years in London, all right? And Japan is together with Korea, they are the last two ports on our east side before you can get to America. All right, so once you pass Singapore, if you don't purchase bunker there, your trade is probably more east side. You have only those two options. So your decision making then, yes, is money oriented, but might not be necessarily money oriented. If you have to buy, Japan was traditionally quite expensive. Bunkering port, complicated, difficult, very efficient, but difficult. And you pay a premium. But if you have no options, you pay a premium. If there's only one petrol station and it costs €3 per liter and there's nothing in the range of 100 kilometers and you have 5 kilometers left on board of petrol to go, you would put the petrol, maybe the minimum, but you would put the minimum to reach next.
It's come in the highway, on the highway with your car, if you need, in the area, it's expensive.
So it's, but of course, when you can take a decision, let's say you go to ski Megève this winter, and you know there's a petrol station just outside the motorway. Once you arrive there, that is cheaper than any others. But can you reach there? Maybe not. Maybe, so then you put the fuel elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
So there are a lot of factors, of course, entering the decision. So yes, you choose the cheapest, but the cheapest according to your actual logistic, because still you need to run the ship first.
Okay. What about Middle East and Houston, US?
Houston is quite cheap. I wouldn't call it cheap. Americans, they like to make money, so they tend to keep it for themselves, you know, not to give a freebie to everyone. It's very regulated, America, so it's very safe. Therefore, you have cost adding up there. But yes, it's one another place as Southern Asia, where you have refineries, you have crude, everything is pretty much there. Middle East, it's more an emerging market, if we can call it that way, in the past 10, 15, 20 years. So they have increased, obviously, Fujairah as a main bunkering hub of the Middle East. It's been increasing the quantity since 20, 25 years ago. But it's, how I put it, geographically, it's not well placed.
Yeah, it's only
unless you go there,
yeah,
you don't pass by there.
Yeah, okay. And then especially now, with you cannot pass through the Red Sea and Suez Canal, so less.
So the bunkering, in this case, the bunkering demand is driven by the commodity demand locally. So all the cargo exported would drive the demand of the bunker. While Singapore, it's a bunker-only call by definition.
Yeah.
So ships are not actually going to Singapore to discharge,
yeah, exactly,
or load necessary. Of course, some of them do.
Do, but not all.
But not all.
Yeah.
They just pass by. Mm-hmm. And Rotterdam has the advantage of being the hub of Europe. So every ship that gets there then through trucks and train, you know, gets all the goods are distributed into Europe, yeah, basically, all right? So each location has a particularity or a reason for having such a market.
Okay.
And when we said before, yes, if you increase $100 per ton the product in Singapore, you would see a shift of some of this demand to nearest areas, but you will not be able to remove the full captive demand from there just because of the price, because some of the demand is captive, so it's there by definition.
Okay.
You can only play within a certain quantity, but then it's not going to go to zero, and the same for Fujairah, it's not going to go to zero. But you won't send your ship on purpose to Fujairah to save $20 per ton, so instead of going through to Cape on South Africa, you know, obviously
you need to take into
account, but you have
okay. Interesting. I want to ask you a last question.
Sure.
What kind of advices, tips can you give to younger future, I would say,
younger bunker traders? All right. Yes. So what I would say, I of course I like this job. I've done it for a while and I still enjoy it every day. I think the best part of it is the fact that it's not extremely difficult as a job in the way that you need to have a specialization. You don't need to be a doctor. You don't need to be an engineer to be able to do such a job. It's quite simple itself. But you need memory, because you need to remember everyone. You need to remember every port and what is available there, who's available there. And you need to have, as we said in the beginning, skills. But if you do have this kind of stuff, it's actually fun.
Okay.
It's fun. Okay. You travel.
Yeah.
You meet a lot of people different from your belongings.
Yeah.
So you confront yourself with someone who has completely different background, completely different culture, but you still do the same stuff. And that is such an enrichment, I think, for any of us. And you do have still specialization. I mean, being an Italian, of course, it worked better with some of the Mediterranean clients because of, you know, same attitude to life, same vision of life. And someone works better with maybe Scandinavian because they have the... But you could find yourself in between all this, in the middle of this, while, you know, not every job gives you the chance. If you're a doctor, well, amazing. You probably work in your country where you have studied. If you're a lawyer, you study the law and that law works only there. While this one, you know, even for traveling, you know, we were saying before, you could move.
You can move.
You can move.
It's freedom at the end, actually.
And this is the greatest thing. Then I always, when I started the job, and I always thought, you know, I am from Genoa. It's a seaside city. You have ferries going to the island. And then my mother's family comes from Sardinia Island. And I used to go there on holiday in summer. And I was taking the ferry from Genoa to north of Sardinia every summer, or at least twice a summer. And I was wondering, sometimes we depart very late. And I couldn't understand, all right? I was like, so they said, you know, embankment on the ship starts from, let's say, 3 p.m.
Yeah.
Ships will depart at 8 p.m. Everyone is on board. Not leaving. I was on the deck, you know. I never thought about it. Then I realized she was doing bunker. And there was a delay in the bunker. And we delayed the departure of 2 hours, 3 hours, 5 hours. Maybe she was late from the previous trip because of the weather, but she still needs bunker. Even though in 3 hours she's ready to sail with the passengers, in 3 hours she's not ready to sail because of the bunker. I never thought about that. Then I realized how much is the impact of something like that, which is the hidden part of the business, on a lot of our things around us. Because ships, at the end of the day, they pretty much deliver everything we use every day, all right? And then if you have an issue on a ship, and if it's related to bunker, well, you got an affection there, and, you know, side effect that would affect in somehow your life, you don't even know about it. And then I found very interesting getting to know what is behind the scene, something that, well, I've never imagined before. Well, same for the airplanes, you know, of course they are quicker, but the point is the same, you know. At the end of the day, you know, there is something that would affect your life and you have no clue about it, because we only think that everything is ready like this. But there's a ready like this, there's a reason. If it's efficient as well, on the bunker.
That's so true, actually. Yeah, thank you, Davide, for this very insightful episode. It's well, even myself, I learned a lot. It was a real masterclass. Thank you.
Thanks to you for having me. It's a good time, fun time.
Yeah, together. Fun. And of course, I wish you all the best in your
Thank you very much. Life. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a lovely day and weekend.
Thank you for listening and watching this episode. We are looking forward to bring you more insights from maritime professionals, experts, and students. Do not hesitate to follow the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Your support means a lot to us and helps us to bring you more content.